More than 140,000 Alaskans get essential health care coverage from Medicaid, and it costs the state more than $700 million a year to provide that coverage. Medicaid is one of the biggest drivers of the state operating budget, and costs for the program are increasing at an unsustainable rate. State officials say reforming the program is necessary. But what will that reform look like? I'm Annie Feit. We'll discuss it today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Earlier this year, the state convened the Medicaid Reform Advisory Group. Their number one goal is to figure out a way to ensure the Medicaid budget is stable, predictable, and sustainable. The panel's first report to the legislature is due on November 15th. I have two guests joining me to discuss the problems with the Medicaid budget and the options for reform. Bill Struer is Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, and Josh Appleby is Deputy Director of Healthcare Policy at the Department of Health and Social Services. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Annie.
And a bit later in the show, we'll be talking with Becky Hultberg, who is President and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. And we'd like you to join the discussion, too. Are you a patient who receives Medicaid or a provider who accepts Medicaid payments? Call 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422, or email talk@alaskapublic.org. And Commissioner Struer, let's start with just kind of the big question here. Why does Medicaid need to be reformed?
Annie, Medicaid costs in Alaska are second to none in the nation. We are the most expensive Medicaid program of all 50 states, and those costs continue to go up. Unpredictably, they continue to go up. We've implemented, our magic trick box has run out of ways in which we could reduce Medicaid costs, control Medicaid costs, and so we need to look at reform. What can we do better? Where can we generate savings? How can we create a healthier population or help our population become more healthy in what they do?
And why should the average Alaskan who doesn't receive Medicaid care about this?
Because of Medicaid's effect on the total budget. $700 million of general fund coming out of the budget every year and growing at 3 to 5 to 7% in previous years. A year is eventually going to chew up significant portions of the budget, and the budget that would otherwise go for roads, for schools, for law enforcement, for public safety. The money has to come from somewhere, particularly with a fairly flat budget as we have.
And before we get deep into the reform discussion, let's just talk about what Medicaid is. What is Medicaid?
Medicaid is a health plan, health insurance, if you will, for those without an ability to pay for that, those below 100% of poverty level, primarily children and adults and families with children, and the disabled and other limited groups.
Can you describe like a typical Medicaid recipient, or is that impossible?
It's impossible. Just look at the general population. You'll see a typical Medicaid recipient. As I said, it's largely children and families with children. And there's lots of those that are not Medicaid recipients, the same group. It's folks that are either down on their luck or folks that are unable to work for one reason or another. And 100% of poverty level, it's about $14,000 for an individual, going up slightly, depending on family size, but fairly unsustainable ability to live on those amount of funds, and giving those folks health care coverage so that they don't end up being chronically disabled or other challenges.
And we think, I think people who know about Medicaid, you think of it as being for children and pregnant women. Who are those other groups? I mean, you talked a little bit about it, but can you get deeper into who else accesses this program?
I listed briefly the disabled population. Others are families with children, families with small children primarily, not just pregnant women, but there's limited coverage for families. Josh, help me out.
Seniors, we talk about long-term care.
Those that are dual covered, seniors that have Medicare, but are below a certain income level, and for their Medicare co-pays or for services not covered by Medicare, Medicaid will pick those up as well.
And how does Alaska's Medicaid program stack up against others in the country? You said that we're more generous, I think, is the bottom line, but explain that.
We are more generous. We're one of the richest benefits packages in the nation. I believe we're in the top five for sure, and probably top one. We're certainly top one in costs in the nation. We pay better. Medicaid programs in other states up until this year were paying less than Medicare. We pay about 140% of Medicare rates in Alaska.
And then, well, how was that system developed?
I think the system just kind of grew that way during the periods of largesse and during the periods when there was lots of funding available for Medicaid, and we continue to enrich the benefit to make that available for Alaskans.
Well, I think, and how it grew, Annie, is when you have an initial program and how programs start, the federal government will subsidize a large portion of that early on. And then as the years go on, they might reduce that less and less and less. And so the state portion of that gets higher over time as well. And so each time there becomes a new program, a new waiver program, a new population to cover, during those periods where we have a lot of money, the state says, this is a good idea, we're going to go forward with this. But there's never a time where it says, we can't afford this, we need to go back to where we were.
And are there benefits, Josh, in Alaska's Medicaid program that aren't typically offered in other states?
Well, typically offered is a hard term. Because when you've seen one Medicaid program, you've seen one Medicaid program. There are 51 very unique Medicaid programs across the country, and they've evolved differently throughout the course of the program. Alaska's is very generous. We offer a substantial number of optional services that are not required under the federal law, but can be provided as optional services to those client bases.
The majority of the services offered under Medicaid are first dollar coverage. It's a health plan that you or I certainly couldn't afford. And it's just about coverage for just about everything that a person can encounter in terms of healthcare needs. And we don't restrict. And the only restriction that we would have is we only cover to 100% of poverty level.
For the recipient.
For the recipients.
Okay. How did we get in a spot where this program became unsustainable?
Once again, I think it's a matter of time. Josh talked about it, where when the federal benefits began to be reduced, we continued to maintain those benefits on the state as a part of the state program. We've continued to ensure that those individuals that require health care coverage, require health care, receive a premium benefit.
And does the state think that that's important to still continue to do that?
I haven't seen anything to indicate that there's a willingness to reduce the benefit. We hear the saber rattling frequently, but when suggestions are made, we also hear the saber rattling going the other way in terms of maintaining the benefit.
It's a difficult proposition. The term that the commissioner likes to use is squeezing the balloon. So, for example, one of the optional benefits that we provide are pharmacy benefits. And so if we were to discontinue paying for prescription drugs, you might squeeze the balloon and see it pop out with higher emergency room visits and additional costs down the line. And so it's a very delicate balance between saying we want to reduce the cost of the program overall, but we don't want to cut the benefits that we're providing.
And what are the biggest cost drivers in the program?
Right now, I think one of the biggest cost drivers continues to be our waiver programs. The waiver programs are the programs that are put in place for recipients who are determined eligible for nursing home level of care. And the waiver programs are designed to give them an option to being in a nursing home. It might be assisted living homes, which we have an extensive panel of providers providing those services. It might be in-home services. It might be transportation services related to those to the care that they receive. It might be day treatment services. But the program has just continued to grow, and the waiver program is now our fastest growing. Waiver and personal care attendant programs are our fastest growing programs in the state right now. Our acute hospital services, our physician services are generally stable.
And how much do providers across the state rely on the income from Medicaid? I mean, I'm sure it varies a lot, but can you give me a sense of that?
I think that for a good portion of the non-physician, non-hospital services, the majority of providers are pretty much Medicaid providers. That's their primary source of income. You look at a lot of the mental health services. You look at, as I said, the waiver services, the in-home care services, the home health services. Those are all primarily Medicaid-related services. Even in our nursing homes, better than 70% of most of the nursing home population are Medicaid recipients. So it's a substantial amount of income for those individuals to maintain and keep the array of services that we do offer to Medicaid recipients.
Okay, and if you want to join the discussion, we're talking about Medicaid reform today. Give us a call here at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, you can call 550-8422. And you can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. We do have an email from Jeff Wells. He says $30,000 procedure costs $400 in Thailand. Fly people to Thailand or bring Thai doctors here and have a duty-free zone for Medicaid doctors without borders in the state. Why does it cost so much? Because there are no laws against it. But do you have a response to that?
I have no argument. yeah. I'm Medicare eligible right now, and as I look at procedures that come with my aging, I look at those out-of-state, out-of-country services, and he is correct about Thailand. A friend of mine had a complete heart procedure done in Thailand for under $16,000 that included a stay in a 5-star hotel.
But it sounds like it would be, I assume it would be complicated for the state to allow an extensive travel program like that.
Medicaid is not into, the Medicaid program in Alaska is not into healthcare tourism, if you will, flying folks out if we can provide the service in state. If it becomes unaffordable in state, then we'd have to take a look at it. But I don't see that on my horizon anytime soon.
Yeah, there's a real risk that you run going down the road of healthcare tourism. If you start shipping people out of state for, say, a given set of procedures, you'll see that the offering of that procedures in state just goes away. And so you really got to work that balance, because if we want to foster a healthy, affordable healthcare network in the state, then we need to make sure that we have the patients, so the providers have something, a market there in which to provide that service.
And that question does get at the high cost of healthcare in Alaska. How much is that part of this discussion? And I mean, what can you do about it?
Well, I think the only way we can do about the only thing we can do about really is to enlist our providers in helping us find a solution, because it rests with the providers. It rests with in terms of the amount of services provided, discretion about how those services are provided, and the cost of those services. And eventually, there's got to be some squeezing and coming together and finding a solution for that.
Okay, well, let's talk about the Medicaid Reform Advisory Group. Who is on that panel besides yourself, Commissioner?
There's a total of 9 individuals plus myself, representatives of the tribal community, representatives of the industry, consumers in terms of the small business group. Josh, help me out. I'm losing it.
Do you want actual names? I mean, we can go through the names of the 9 members.
Sure, go ahead.
We have Senator John Coghill representing the Senate. We have Representative Pete Higgins from the House. We have Gene Peltola, who's a former CEO out there at YKHC. We have Renee Axelson, who works for Geneva Woods Pharmacy. We have Kevin Turkington with Midnight Sun Care. We have Dr. Iona Farr as a provider representative. We have Sandra Heffern with her small business experience and her healthcare background. She's been great. Is that 9?
I wasn't counting. That's why I don't go into names.
I think that's good enough. Have you had a lot of public involvement in the process?
I think public involvement has been fairly limited overall. We've had public testimony from ANTHC, our tribal partners. We've had public testimony from the Alaska Primary Care Association, from Becky Holtberg, who will be on the program a little later. She's provided public testimony. A couple members from within the tribal system have come up to provide public testimony. But for the most part, it's been limited to the provider community. We haven't heard from patient representatives in person. We've gotten a couple emails and some commentary of what's gone on. But when the governor set up this advisory group and when the commissioner outlined his expectations for it, he stated from the very beginning, we will dedicate as much time as we need each meeting for public testimony. And to be quite honest, it hasn't been used. It hasn't been fully utilized in any single meeting yet. We haven't had to say we need to cut off public testimony. We've been in positions of saying, anybody else, is there really anybody else in the room that wants to say something? And I think part of that comes from the fact that Medicaid is so complicated. And it's so broad and some people are just unwilling to step out on a limb on one side of it because it might affect another side of it.
One of the other things that I was hoping to get out of these was that the community would step forth with suggestions on ways in which we can either improve or reduce the cost of Medicaid. And what we've gotten is largely reaction to the initiatives that we've brought forward. And I know there's better solutions out there, and so we continue to elicit those and to try to put back in front of the governor some real ways to reform Medicaid for the betterment of all Alaskans, and not only in terms of treatment but in terms of cost.
And we're still accepting public testimony and still accepting ideas from people who do have them. We set up a specific email for it. Very simple. It's medicaid.reform@alaska.gov. So anybody that has an idea of how we can make the Medicaid program sustainable, more responsible to providers, ways of integrating mental health a little more cleaner in terms of the primary care side of it, those are the three instructions that we received from the governor that he wants us to accomplish. So if they want to, anybody wants to send us an email, we're more than willing to accept it.
Okay, well, we have another email from a listener. Carrie McLean says, Medicaid, like most of the U.S. for-profit healthcare system, pretends that dental health is some kind of extra fancy benefit that's unrelated to overall health. Many people on Medicaid have rotten or missing teeth, which has severe impacts on their overall health, which leads to costly interventions. Carrie is from Sitka. How is dental handled in
Medicaid? Medicaid does provide dental coverage, and it's a fairly healthy benefit, and it's available to most Medicaid recipients. It's been a part of the program. It was added by the legislature back in, I want to say, the mid-2000s, and it's early years we had trouble even being able to utilize the money, and it's been improving, and we're seeing increasing utilization. The denture, the number of dentures that we provided to individuals has been stunning, and it's always interesting to me to go out to a village and talk to someone who, one case, person was so proud of it that they were getting dentures because they'd be able to eat caribou meat again. And that was the biggest thing to him was, I'm going to be able to eat caribou meat again. So it is a part of our program. We do offer it. I would never call Medicaid a for-profit program in any respect.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the Alaska Medicaid Innovations List. This is the document that the Medicaid Reform Advisory Group has put together, and it's kind of, who wants to explain what it is?
Well, the list that you're looking at is a list of those ideas. We put forth a total list of about 25 items at two meetings ago, and we presented them very raw form, some real basic descriptions of what they mean, and the advisory group went through and eliminated a section of them that said, these are things the department should do anyway. So the department should just go do those things. But here's a list of items that we want you to come back with a more detailed description. We want you to look into it a little bit more deeply. We want you to flesh out maybe some preliminary numbers. How many people is this going to affect? What kind of cost savings or cost increases are we looking at? And come back to us with a little bit more robust discussion. And so the list that you're looking at is that initial robust discussion for the advisory group to go through and say, is this something we really want to move forward with, or is it something that we don't see has any legs and isn't going any further?
And are you trying to narrow it down to three ideas, or is there no set target?
We never set a specific target. We want to do what can be done. The advisory group isn't interested in recommending to the governor the pie in the sky, this will solve everything sort of idea that is never going to be implemented. I think everyone there is very good about looking at the practicality of it and saying, is this something that can actually be done? If so, can it be done in less than 10 years? Okay, then let's talk about it.
And so what are some of those ideas?
Well, there's 14 of the 23 that are left. The sad part about the other nine is that they basically, the group said the department ought to be doing this anyway, so take it on. And no, seriously, it's something, some of the things that we needed to do. It's a wide group. We recommended the development of a care management program. Care management program for addressing the overutilization of Medicaid services by certain recipients. Helping folks get connected with a primary care physician instead of the emergency room is a good example of one that we would use. Helping someone who has 15 prescriptions with a diagnosis that doesn't warrant 15 prescriptions and getting them connected with a physician or a pharmacist who can look through those prescriptions and make sure that they're appropriate to the care that they're receiving, appropriate to the disease or the disease state or the health challenge that they have. Comprehensive payment reform working group, and that's addressing the entire range of payments that we make to providers, and how can we affect patient or payment reform on that? Should there be co-pays implemented? Should we bundle payments such as Medicare is doing? And other initiatives that could be taken under that. But bringing a group of people together to sit and work through this and actually implement meaningful reform that providers, patients, and payers can deal with.
Yeah, that gets really back to the predictability in budgeting that the governor was looking for. When you start talking about bundled payments, care coordination, and those sort of those ideas, and under this broad umbrella of payment reform, the idea is to get to a more predictable level of how much can we budget for year to year to year. One of the arguments that I know one of the ideas people like to throw around is we need biannual budgets. We need to do a budget for every 2 years. Entitlement programs like Medicaid make that impossible to go from 1 year to the next with the swings in utilization in terms of cost of health care. It can be real devastating on budget planning.
Okay, well, we have a few callers on the line. Let's go to Thomas in Anchorage.
Hello.
Hi, you're on Talk of Alaska.
Well, I was a PCA years ago, and they were concerned about the cost of in-home health care, took care of quadriplegics, and so they came out with this, rather than bill directly, that there would be an agency in the middle. And so I was making $8.50 an hour, and then had to switch to an agency who paid me $8.50 an hour, but they were paid 20-some dollars an hour to do that. As a method to control costs, and seemed to me like that more than doubled it.
So you're saying there's a middleman somewhere in there? Is that something?
Yeah, now there's a middleman, and you know, if I'm a quadriplegic at home, and I want to hire somebody, we have an agency in the middle that does the billing and pays the taxes and sends me a check. Rather than the check coming directly to the provider, it goes to the agency that hires the provider. And so instead of it, I don't know what they pay now, but instead of $9 an hour only just to the provider, they're paying 20-some dollars an hour for the agency to pay the provider $9 an hour.
Okay, let's see if we have Commissioner Stewart, do you have a response to that?
You know, there isn't a good response to it other than I believe that the attempt to go with agencies as opposed to individual providers was primarily related to ensuring that the quality of care is there, that the billing is able to be accomplished, and that the overall site management and care of the individual is ensured.
Okay, thanks for your call, Thomas. And we also have Joe on the line from Anchorage. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your question?
I guess I'd want to ask the question is, why is the government's role to give such high level of care when the money is short?
Okay, Commissioner.
You know, if there's not, go ahead.
You know, it's a good question because I think you heard me say, you probably heard me say earlier that you and I can't afford to buy the coverage that Medicaid offers. The majority of the Medicaid program is mandated by the federal government. The level of service, the amount of service. The states then do an a la carte add-on of things. And we added the waiver programs largely. We added the pharmacy program, which is a huge cost. Transportation is a significant issue in Alaska, and we spend about $80 million a year on transportation for Medicaid recipients. So you add those all up.
Right, right.
Go ahead.
Joe, did you?
It expensive very quickly.
Yeah.
And it does add up very quickly. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I guess I'm just thinking there's the quality of the service if the money gets cut down by the federal government not providing it, so it would be I believe you said that the quality of service Alaska gives is better than other states. Well, it's costing us, so why not you don't need to but you go in accordance with the budget.
And Joe, I think that is one of the innovations on the list. Why don't one of you, Josh or Commissioner Stewart, do you want to address that? Well, that is on the table.
It is on the table, but I think it's very much a part of the entire function of the Medicaid Reform Advisory Group is how do we ensure that the quality of care is there, the access to care is there, but that it's a little more parsimonious. And less expensive, if you will. And so we have to look at that. We have to.
So where are the inefficiencies?
Exactly right. Are we providing too many CT scans? Are we providing too many surgeries? Are we replacing too many knees? And are we allowing too many emergency room visits? All that is being looked at as a part of this reform. And we have to take a look at it. And you're exactly right. We can't afford this. And so we need to figure out a better way to do it.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Joe.
And
we'll discuss this more in a minute. But first, we have to take a quick break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska. I'm Annie Feit, and we're talking about Medicaid reform today. I'm here with Commissioner Bill Struer and Josh Appleby from the Department of Health and Social Services. And we have a couple of emails that have come in. Lots of people want to participate in this discussion. Carolyn says, a lot of really innovative ideas seem to get caught up in bureaucracy or cannot be implemented because of due process concerns for current recipients. Is the state looking at smaller scale testing or privatized testing of reform ideas? Josh, do you want to answer that?
I don't know what privatized testing is, but I know one of the things that we need to caution ourselves with in terms of too many pilot programs, too many demonstration ideas out there, not getting to the end result, which is then ramping up that idea and moving it across the system. Some of these ideas have to go through a pilot program. There's no way we're going to risk quality of care, access of care, just to see something that's not going to work across the system. And so, yes, those considerations are there, starting small and ramping up. But if it's something that's going to be implemented system-wide, then starting a pilot project might not be the smartest thing to do right away.
Okay. And Becky Hultberg is on the line right now. She's joining us from Juneau. She's president and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. Hi, Becky.
Hi, Annie. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. How important is Medicaid funding to your members?
Well, Medicaid funding is hugely important to our members. I guess the degree of importance really varies, and that's something that I think is a nuance that hasn't really been discussed much in this process of Medicaid reform. Some of our members are up to 90% Medicaid funded. Others have a much smaller percentage of Medicaid. So obviously when you're talking about changes, the percentage of Medicaid that a provider sees is a really important variable in ensuring continuity of care.
And which of those which of your members are more like 90%? Give us a picture of who that is, who's so dependent.
Long-term care facilities are have a very high percentage of Medicaid. Some of our adolescent residential treatment programs are also very high percentage of Medicaid. So I think you have to be very aware of the payer mix, is what it's called, the different types of payers that pay a facility and what percentage they are. When you're looking at these proposals, if you're going to avoid unintended consequences of reduced access to services.
Do you agree that the Medicaid budget is unsustainable and that reform is necessary?
I think our members would agree that you know, healthcare is changing rapidly. Reform is happening everywhere. So it's, you know, you can't really be in the healthcare field and not say that yeah, reform is probably necessary and inevitable. But how we do that, how we structure that process to get there, is hugely critical. And, you know, that process really needs to involve a broad array of stakeholders. It needs to be ongoing, and it really needs to be resourced. There are really, really smart people who are struggling every day and working hard to find the solution to how do we deliver high-quality care at a lower cost. And so this is not there is not a simple quick fix. And, in fact, the simple quick fixes can have really drastic long-term consequences. And that's really one of our concerns in this process, is that we're looking sufficiently long-term and that the changes that are being proposed will actually have an impact in the long term that not only manages cost but ensures the continuity of services.
So what would be one of those quick fixes that you're concerned about?
Well, certainly a rate freeze is a quick fix. A rate freeze does, you know, just says basically we're not going to increase your Medicaid rate by the inflationary factor it would normally be increased. Again, that sounds like an easy thing to do, like everyone could absorb a one-year rate freeze. However, when you look at those providers that are already being reimbursed at cost and then don't get any kind of an inflationary adjustment while their costs continue to go up, that can be very damaging if they're a high percentage of Medicaid. So there's a lot of nuance and a lot of complexity in healthcare that I'm not sure has been brought forward through this process that I think we need to make sure and consider before any final decisions are made.
What kind of solutions do you think could work?
Well, you know, I'm not going to. I think that it's overly probably simplistic for me to sit here and say what I think will solve our healthcare problem. But what I can tell you is what has worked in other states. And what has worked in other states has been the state government sitting down at the table with providers and with payers, other payers, and really working through what, over the long term, the state's goals are and how providers can help the state meet those goals. And I think, as I said, in other states, that's being done right now through Medicaid expansion, quite candidly. This group was formed in part because of the governor's decision on Medicaid expansion. There's not been a lot of discussion about the gap population, but real reform in other states is being driven through Medicaid expansion. And so I think there's a missed opportunity here if we're not going to consider reform through expansion, because a lot of the things that are on the table right now are not that long-term systemic reform. They are shorter-term tweaks to programs and then caps on rates that might help the state budget in the short term, but over the long term are just going to squeeze that proverbial balloon, and we're not going to see that sustained decrease in healthcare costs or sustained flattening out in healthcare costs, which is what the state really needs.
And how do you think Medicaid expansion would be part of reform?
Well, I think it's one time when you have everybody at the table together as willing partners. It's certainly in the provider's best interest to have Medicaid expansion because of the high percentage of uncompensated care that many especially hospital providers have. So I think you have a lot of willing partners ready to come together and say, how together can we make this system look different? I think another important point is that a lot of, if you look at what reform is happening in other states, increasingly providers are being asked to take risk. They're being asked to care for a population and take the risk for the cost of care of that population. You can only take that risk if you're in a position of financial stability. That's where the future of reform is going, is more risk on providers. And that, you know, may be an appropriate direction for healthcare to head. But if we're going to move to that place where we're seeing other states move, we have to make sure not to undercut our foundation right now.
Okay, well, thanks, Becky.
All right, thank you, Annie.
Becky Hultberg is president and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. And Commissioner Stewart, do you want to respond to some or all of what Becky said? Should Medicaid expansion be part of this discussion?
Well, I'm not saying Medicaid expansion shouldn't be part of any discussion, but before we spend another $200 million of general fund over the next 5 years, 6 years, We need to come up with ways in where we can effect real savings. Becky talked briefly about the cost of uncompensated care. Well, what is that cost? And how much of that cost would the hospitals be willing to give up in terms of rate reductions to assist with the cost of implementing a Medicaid expansion? And I'm not sure that our system of Medicaid right now, as we provide it, being the most expensive Medicaid program in the nation, healthcare in Alaska being the most expensive healthcare in the nation, in a world where the United States is the most expensive healthcare in the world, meaning Alaska is now the most expensive healthcare in the world. And you know, we have to do something about it. And we're going to add more lives to a program that is unsustainable and unworkable without doing some reform. This is incremental. Yes, it is. But the provider system needs to step forward and tell us ways in which we can work together to do this. And frankly, we haven't seen this.
Well, what about Becky's idea that Medicaid expansion, would be such a positive thing for the provider community that they would come to the table if that was more on the table?
They haven't come forward with what they would put on the table and what they would offer up. I would love to hear them come forward and say that. If uncompensated care costs the hospitals $200 million a year, should half of that uncompensated care be affected in rate reductions so that our private insurance costs go down, so that our Medicaid inpatient and outpatient hospital costs go down, to be able to offset the $230 million that's projected by Lewin as the cost between now and 2020 to do a Medicaid expansion.
Okay, we have another caller on the line. Rich is in Fairbanks. Hi, Rich.
Hello.
What's your question?
Well, I think there's an elephant in the room here that I haven't heard mentioned, and that is that, you know, all of these costs could be ameliorated to some degree, and I agree there are lots of dimensions of problems. But the governor and the administration have refused to accept one of the Medicare assistance programs that could mean millions of dollars to the state and would help 40,000 Alaskans, and that hasn't been mentioned as a way to ameliorate costs. That seems to be a policy of the state, and it seems to be politically driven to not participate in the president's health care reform. I'd like to hear answers as to why Alaska is not taking that federal assistance, which I think would cover a great deal of the costs.
And so you're talking about Medicaid expansion?
Yes.
Okay. Commissioner Stewart, do you want to, we were just talking about that, but do you want to explain more in detail why the state hasn't decided against expansion?
Sure. I talked about this $230 million between now and 2020. An additional general fund that's going to need to be expended. By 2020, we're going to spend $70 million a year to do that same Medicaid expansion that Rick is just talking about, that Becky has talked about. And frankly, with our current budget situation, with oil prices where they are, with our throughput out of the oil that we have, with the needs for education and law enforcement and public safety, there's got to be give somewhere. And frankly, I don't see the revenue being able to sustain all those needs and a Medicaid expansion as well.
Okay, thanks for your call, Rich. Constantine is on the line from St. George. Hello?
Yes, hello.
And what's your question?
About 3 years ago, I got medevaced out of here, and, I didn't have Medicaid, but, being Alaska Native, I thought I didn't need it, but now I'm getting a bill from Guardians, like, for $87,000, which I can't even pay for. You know, I wasn't wondering if, Sean Parnell would do something about it to help me out on this, because the bills of being medevaced or whatever, those things are really expensive, no matter what. If you charter a plane, it's only like $10,000.
Yeah.
But the Medivac plane is, will cost you an extra $70,000.
Yeah, Commissioner Stewart already mentioned that transportation costs are a huge driver in Medicaid funding. What's your response?
Well, I really don't have any solutions for you on that. You mentioned you were a tribal member. I think that best advice I can give is go to a local health clinic or contact your tribal health organization and see if they can't figure out a way to work with you and Guardian to mitigate some of those costs. But if you're not a current Medicaid recipient, Medicaid can't pick up the costs. But your tribal health organization definitely can help in terms of negotiating with Guardian.
And what do you recommend that tribal members, if they are eligible, that they get Medicaid?
Definitely. Tribal members, if they're eligible for Medicaid, they need to get signed up. And if they don't know if they're eligible, they need to go in and see if they're eligible. It's a great program. For tribal members, we get 100% federal reimbursement for the program. And if the care is delivered in a tribal health organization, and we strongly advocate for that, as do the tribal health organization. So,
okay, we have another email from Jean. She says, having worked with children and families in rural Alaska for many years, I recognize the importance of Medicaid. Costs might be reduced, however, if families were required to bundle their medical and dental visits. It would be more cost-effective for parents to fly in from remote areas with all of their children for a busy day of dental health instead of coming in every month or so.
It's a good point. When I was Medicaid director a few years ago, many years ago now it seems, that was one of the issues that we addressed. We would find families that would fly in from a remote village and with their five children for their annual dental checkups, and the family would set one appointment for Monday, one for Tuesday, one for Wednesday, one for Thursday, one for Friday. And, you know, it's a bit of a treat to come into the big city for some folks, and we understand that. But being able to bundle the appointments has been a significant challenge, but has been a challenge that's been quickly addressed and appropriately addressed in the Medicaid program. So thanks for your suggestion. Anything you do to help on that would be greatly appreciated.
And is that something that the state could, you know, mandate or have more control over?
We don't mandate it, but we strongly suggest it to both the provider and the recipient. We need to move these appointments closer together. And so we're pushing it as much as we can, we think.
Okay, and we need to take another quick break here as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Listening to Talk of Alaska, I'm Annie Feit, and we're talking Medicaid reform. I'm here in the studio with Commissioner Bill Struer and Josh Appleby, and Mary is on the line from Soldotna. Hi, Mary. Thanks for your patience.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. I have a question. I have a question that involves several things, aspects. One, I would like to know what savings have occurred in home. You had mentioned that was the largest growing cost, but it is my understanding. Hello?
Hello, you're fading out there, Mary. Can you back up?
Yeah. Okay, better?
Yeah.
Okay. What's occurred in the population base that is presently being treated at home versus those that are in the nursing home facilities?
Are you looking for the cost difference between?
I'm looking for the cost savings in the individuals that are presently at home versus in the nursing homes.
Mary, as close as I can recall, it's about $26,000 to $30,000 for an individual to be treated in their home on an annual basis, and it's about $165,000 to $180,000 to be treated in nursing homes. So there's substantial savings from in-home care. Plus, I'm one of those folks that believes that the closer you treat a person to their home, the better they are.
And then I think the image that I got as you were discussing this is that the at-home care is increasing, but not how much was being saved by the increase. That's not clear. Not how much is being saved in the state by doing it that way. So what I can see, or what I understand to be happening, is that the state is saving a great deal of money by treating these people in home. So to picture it as this is getting to be a larger and larger cost, it seems to me a bit edgy.
Well, let me explain that to you, Mary. I think you know that Alaska has an aging population. During the last census, those folks over 55 years of age grew by 70% from 2000 to 2010. The same age group in the lower 48 grew by about 15%. And so we are a rapidly aging population. Well, guess what? As we get older, our health care needs increase. So the need for in-home care is ever increasing. And so there's more people getting treated and receiving the services through the in-home care or the waiver programs. And that's, I think, the big driver behind it, not that it's too expensive. We have to understand that it's an aging population, and it's an aging population that demands higher levels of care. It's more costly to treat us.
Okay, thanks for your call, Mary. And Nick is on the line from Wasilla. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
What's your question?
Oh, I really wanted different options down there about the different things that can be done to help Medicare, but it seems to me like the predominant idea is that we should get the government more involved and have more regulations, and then the government will just fix it somehow. And that's just an anomaly to me on the, you know, based on the Obamacare rollout and how it's doubled fees in 1 year flat, and there's no end in sight. And all of you are talking about partnering with the providers. The providers aren't our partners. They're capitalists, and I'm a capitalist too. I mean, they're my partner in that sense. We're world partners fighting the good fight against all the communism and all the people who are trying to get the government to pay for everything on the backs of our grandchildren, $220 billion in debt. It's absolutely ridiculous. I don't know where the end in sight is. Everybody talks about the kids, and we're passing the buck all day long. So I'm pretty sure government's not the answer. I'm pretty sure if government walked away from health care, immediately rates would just plummet through the ground. And let the buyer beware. Let the product speak for itself. Let consumer demand. The government can't get its fingers in absolutely everything and regulate absolutely every business and every person. The government can't be both sides and the arbiter of every freaking transaction. It's ridiculous. We are out of money. What's the plan?
Okay, Nick, we'll get a plan here from Josh Appleby.
Well, I think Nick brings up an interesting point in that the healthcare system in and of itself is not a market the way we see markets. You don't have the information going from the consumer and the provider. I think one of the things that comes out of reform, whether it be healthcare reform, Medicaid reform, any sort of reform, is that more information needs to be available to consumers. And one of the things that we talked about earlier was that explanation of benefits. Sending something out to Medicaid recipients that says, look, this is the cost of the care that you just received. Because there's an absolute disconnect. And I think that's exactly where Nick was going on his point, is that there's a disconnect now between the consumer and the supplier. And if we can do anything in terms of reform, is to increase the amount of information flow between the healthcare providers and the recipients of that healthcare as to what the actual cost is, whether they have to pay for it as part of their own insurance, or if it's paid for through a government system. Just that knowledge of what it's costing and getting that information exchanged, I think, will do a lot towards how consumers use healthcare in the state.
Okay. And we have Representative Paul Seaton on the line from Homer. Hi, Representative.
Hi, I'm glad we're having this conversation today. You know, I just wanted to bring in the other part of this that I haven't heard, and that is not just trying to contain costs by changing rates, but actually preventing disease. And in 2011, the legislature unanimously passed a resolution calling on the governor to take us to a prevention of disease model for health care instead of our just paying for sick care when it occurs. And unless we start moving in that direction, I don't see how we're going to reform a system that works well. But we've got all kinds of studies in 2013 and 2014 looking at, tremendous drop in the rate of cavities in Canada if they have adequate vitamin D. We know we can prevent anywhere from 65 to 90% of type 2 diabetes cases. I mean, these are all studies that are current, ongoing out there, and unfortunately, the medical community, or at least the state, has not stepped up and implemented any of the procedures that would need to go forward to have prevention of disease, other than vaccinations. And I'm not opposed to vaccinations. It's, you know, it's one way of preventing certain things, but we've got a whole lot of things that we can work on for prevention of disease, and that's the way we're going to actually be able to change the cost of the healthcare system instead of just who pays. So I hope that as we go forward, we put in the big question on the table is how do we prevent these diseases? I mean, Alaska is on the worst end of so many of the disease rates, and we can change that around quite a bit. But unless we do, we're going to be in a world of hurt.
Okay, well, thanks, Representative. We just have like a minute left here. Do you want to weigh in on that, Commissioner Josh?
Well, Representative Seaton is exactly right. And you can throw whatever catchphrase you want at it, that this isn't healthcare, this is sick care, all the rest of that. But he's exactly right. Focus on prevention, having better health outcomes, and if you keep people well, it's cheaper than to treat them when they're sick. And he's exactly right on that point.
Okay. I think that's a great spot to end today's show. That's all we have time for. Thanks to my guests, Commissioner Bill Struer and Josh Appleby. They're both with the Department of Health and Social Services. Also, Becky Hultberg joined us from the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. Thanks for listening to Talk of Alaska. Dave Waldron was our engineer. Josh Edge and Ashley Snyder were on the phones. And I'm Annie Feit.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.